Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
The explanation from the BBC World Service takes a deep dive into the big stories affecting our lives, giving you an unvarnished explanation of the world. Search for The Explanation wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Jeanette Jaleel, and in the early hours of Tuesday, the 12th of September, these are our main stories. Moroccan villagers hit by last week's devastating earthquake say aid isn't reaching them quickly enough. Heavy floods triggered by a powerful storm in eastern Libya have killed at least 200 people. Cocaine production in Colombia has climbed to a record level. Also in this podcast,
she became spoiled. The photographers soon discovered that sheep are even less obedient than people who are being photographed.
The scientist who led the team that cloned Dolly the sheep, turning her into a media sensation, Professor Ian Wilmot, has died. We begin in Morocco, where there's been criticism of the speed of the official response to Friday's earthquake, which is now known to have killed more than 2,800 people. Heavy lifting equipment has begun to arrive in remote regions of the Atlas Mountains, which have been the hardest hit. But in many areas, villagers have been digging with their bare hands through the rubble of collapsed homes. Mohsin Fala works at a hotel in a village called Mariga in the region. He described a harrowing scene.
We have a cleaning lady called Habiba. She lost 8 members of her family, including her 7-year-old son. There is no home for her. Her house, it's completely destroyed. So she's there just in a little tent with the rest of her family, waiting to find her son. It's totally, totally horrible feeling that someone of your family just buried under the ground. So everyone just running everywhere and try to help. It's not just because my family are safe, so I'm fine. No, all of them are my families. All of my colleagues works with me, lost someone of the families. I'm sharing the same feelings. I was there when that happened.
A human rights activist in Rabat, Mati Monjib, told the BBC he thought the Moroccan government should have been more open to outside help.
The authorities and the population are doing their best, but it is not enough. And because of that, I don't understand why Morocco didn't send a request for powerful states as France, as the United States, etc. Why it did accept only some propositions from Spain, Great Britain, Qatar and Emirates. Because when it is concerning human beings' lives, I don't understand these political considerations.
My colleague James Kumarasamy spoke to James Copnell, who spent the day travelling in the Atlas Mountains. First, James described what he's been seeing in the city of Marrakech, which has also been badly hit by the quake.
One of the first things I noticed in Marrakech were the number of people sleeping outside. Even though the earthquake took place on Friday, they're still too scared to go back indoors. I met one young woman, Bushra, and I asked her why she'd been sleeping under the stars.
Je dors à l'extérieur parce que tout simplement il y a eu le tremblement de terre et
she says she's sleeping outside because even though the earthquake happened 3 days ago, there's still the trauma from it, and there's just a real fear that something could happen, and it's too dangerous to stay inside, sleep inside. I mean, look, the conditions of sleeping out here in the night is not great. It's not particularly comfortable. It's cold. We're trying to comfort each other, but we're also aware that, you know, the situation for other people in parts of the country is much, much worse. We're really happy just to be alive.
Then we left Marrakech. We headed south into the Atlas Mountains towards the epicentre of this earthquake. All along the route, higher you climbed into the hills, we saw damaged buildings, broken buildings, rubble on the road too, places where the car had to swerve or edge its way past landfall. And then we found a traffic jam created by just so many people traveling into the mountains to these remote villages to bring help. Not in this case, the Moroccan state, but ordinary people loading up their cars with provisions and taking them to their neighbours, their relatives in the villages, their friends, people they didn't know even, but desperate to help out. So many, though, that we got in a traffic jam, and then suddenly rocks started falling, shale started falling from the hillside. And there have been aftershocks over the last couple of days. So a real sense of panic, people jumping out of the cars and moving on. The sense of panic, but also a sense of real determination that whatever the risks, people really wanted to go and help those less fortunate than them who'd been directly caught up in the earthquake.
And what about the government? What has it been saying, and how does that compare to what the people you've met have been telling you?
Well, look, the government is keen to show the work it is doing. It's been sending helicopters to remote places. We saw a couple of those overhead today. Saw a military hospital as well, a field hospital that's been set up to treat people with broken legs and arms and facial wounds and trauma as well. But at the same time, we talked to a lot of people who said, look, I haven't really got much from the government. I've had support, even a tent, some food from Moroccan citizens, and I want more from the state.
James Copnell. Well, James Kumarasamy also spoke to the Moroccan senator, Lassen Haddad, a former tourism minister. What did he make of the claims that much of the help reaching the villages worst affected had come from ordinary Moroccans rather than from the authorities?
I think the response has been incredible. I think it was heroic. And when the earthquake happens, and because it's in the high Atlas Mountains, then most of the roads become blocked. And then some of them are blocked for kilometers and kilometers. The longest one was blocked for about 26 kilometers. So you need like a Herculean effort in order to deal with that.
Are there still areas which haven't been accessed?
The last areas were accessed yesterday at midday, and that's what contributed to the figure of the death toll. It's expected probably to rise as they go through the rubble and then find out about those villages which are close to the epicenter.
The government has accepted aid from a few countries, hasn't it? The UK being one of them, Spain, Qatar, the United Arab Emirates. There has been concern expressed, though, by some that other countries that were ready to offer aid, France and Germany, their aid has not been accepted. Can you explain the thinking there?
I don't think that it has not been accepted. What the Moroccans are saying, look, we know the terrain. The army knows the terrain because it has been dealing with the high Atlas. We know how to get to the population. We have the means now to be able to do that. If we have like something specific where we don't have the expertise, then we're going to call on our friends. For example, like we said, okay, we need dogs, trained dogs and all of that. We have some, but I think the Spanish have expertise in that and they're very close by. They could like just come in very quickly, and that's what we did with the Spanish.
There's no sense then that geopolitical concerns have played into this at all.
I mean, that's the media trying to read some sort of geopolitics into that. I am telling you that only yesterday they got to certain communities and can appreciate the fact that they are only taking stock of what is the loss, what happens. But I mean, I think later in each one of those hundreds of communities, those kinds of camps need to be run, need to be managed, need to be provided food. Maybe we need tents. Maybe we need people who have expertise in dealing with that. The king has given instructions that the reconstruction will start right away. I think we need all the possible aid we can get, like from the French, from the Germans.
The accusation from some was the response was slow and it could have been quicker if there had been more international help. How would you respond to that?
Well, if anyone could explain to me how a rock that weighs like 10 tons would have been quicker to like remove from the road, they need to be my guests. I mean, I think the army engineers and the army corps, the civil protection and the public works, they have all the means and the machinery. So it's not like we don't have machinery to do that. It's not like we don't have engineers.
That was the Moroccan Senator Lassen Haddad. Further east along the North African coast, a deadly storm has brought its own trail of destruction to Libya. The port of Derna has been submerged by floodwater as torrential rain and raging winds ripped through the east of the country, damaging buildings and homes. The Libyan Red Crescent says at least 200 people have died. But local authorities have said that the real figure may be much, much higher. Mike Thompson has been monitoring events in Libya.
It's a scene of devastation from what we're hearing. In the city of Derna, which is around 240 kilometres east of Benghazi, there are reports of as many as 2,000 people having died and thousands more missing. Now, that is unconfirmed, but that is what the Prime Minister of Libya's parallel eastern government, Osamar Hamad, has said. So it has been growing and growing and growing. And of course, when you've got such utter chaos, which is inevitable, as of course, as we saw in the earthquake in Morocco and here too, you know, when you have this sort of devastation, it's very hard for people to know what's going on and to know who's missing, who's died. And in fact, going back to the comment by the Prime Minister of the Eastern Libyan Parliament, I mean, he doesn't say what his sources are to arrive at this figure, which makes you wonder how he got them. And what's supposed to have happened there is that two dams, the municipality says two dams have collapsed and four bridges as well, and completely swamped that that city in water. And it's not the only place, of course. Right across the east there, there's been devastation, including in Benghazi and several other places too. And the floods have caused landslides, which have swept some roads away, severely damaged houses. And it's led to schools being closed, public institutions being closed, and four major oil terminals as well. But obviously, going back to the most important thing, the loss of life. Now, if it is as high as 2,000 people, that is simply terrible. It's hard to find words for that.
Mike Thompson. Ukraine says it's successfully retaken control of four gas drilling platforms in the Black Sea close to Russian-occupied Crimea. The platforms were apparently being used by Russia for military purposes. With more details, here's Paul Adams.
The video and statement released by Ukraine's military intelligence offer a rare glimpse into a contest that's been going on away from the cameras since last year. Ukraine says the gas platforms, established more than a decade ago and occupied by Russia in 2015, have been used as helicopter launch pads and radar stations, part of an ongoing battle for control of the northern Black Sea. In the video, which the BBC has not been able to verify, Ukrainian special forces can be seen removing military equipment and being fired upon from the air. There's no obvious evidence of any further combat, but a spokesman for military intelligence said Russian troops on one of the platforms had been killed.
Paul Adams. The North Korean leader Kim Jong-un has reportedly set off for a much-anticipated summit with the Russian President Vladimir Putin. South Korean media says the armoured train Mr. Kim uses for foreign visits appears to be heading towards the Russian Far East. The two men are expected to discuss the possibility of Pyongyang supplying Moscow with weapons for the war in Ukraine. The summit could take place as soon as Tuesday, although the train does travel at a rather sedate 48 kilometres per hour. So why has Mr. Kim chosen this mode of transport for his first trip abroad in 4 years? Evan Davis heard more from Jean H. Lee, who was the first Pyongyang bureau chief for the Associated Press News Agency.
Aside from being able to control the security on the train, I think it's also important to remember that there's a huge propaganda element to this for Kim Jong-un. This is his big reemergence after 4 years of self-imposed isolation. And the train is hugely symbolic in North Korea. I was just looking at some pictures of his father, his late father, Kim Jong-il, who also took a train to Russia in 2011. And they put out a whole magazine devoted to this train trip to Russia. So there's a lot of propaganda around it. So what Kim Jong-un wants to do is to evoke that Kim family legacy by making this big train trip to Russia.
But his father was someone who was a bit scared of flying, I think, which would explain why he took the train.
Yeah, absolutely. He was notoriously afraid of flying. And so he took the train everywhere, inside the country and abroad. And so I think that was a way for the North Koreans to use his fear of flying and turn it into something that they said was proof of his devotion to the people. So it's pure propaganda. Now, Kim Jong-un, his son, he's a young guy, he's not afraid of flying. What he wants to do is establish his family's hold on power and also show his people, the North Koreans, that he's following in his father's footsteps, his grandfather's footsteps, and also that this traditional ally, Russia, has not forgotten about North Korea and still considers North Korea an important country. So there's a lot of, I think, a lot of propaganda wrapped up in this trip, travel by train, as well, of course, with the deliverables that we're expecting or thinking they may get out of this summit.
Yeah. Now, have you seen the train?
So I have seen the trains that Kim Jong-il and Kim Il-sung, his father and grandfather, took. And I've ridden one of Kim Jong-un's special trains. And I can't say that I rode this special train, but I have ridden one of his special trains. So I know that it is very different than the usual train in North Korea.
I'm not surprised to hear that. Are we talking Orient Express, like posh, or what are we saying here?
I would say, yeah, for North Korea, pretty posh. All the seats were covered with this kind of turquoise brocade fabric. And you can see a picture from the inside of the train on my Twitter feed, on my Twitter profile, because it's the background image for my Twitter. My Twitter handle is NewsGene. But that is a picture that was taken. You'll see one of the women who was serving us, and you know, one of these women who's brought on board to serve us. And so it was interesting too. You go through this countryside that's completely bereft and devastated, and you have soldiers lining that route all the way facing outward to protect the train from any attacks. So it's certainly an unusual way to travel. In some ways, the North Koreans may think that they can control the security better by train.
And that was American journalist Jean H. Lee. The scientist who led the team that created the world's first cloned mammal, Dolly the sheep, has died. Professor Ian Wilmot was 79. Dolly's arrival more than a quarter of a century ago here in the UK was hailed as a groundbreaking scientific development. Reflecting on her life in 2016, Professor Wilmot described how Dolly quickly gained global celebrity status.
She became spoiled. The photographers soon discovered that sheep are even less obedient than people who are being photographed. And if you want her to go to a particular place, you'd have to offer her food. So a result of people doing this several times a day over the period of months, she actually became overweight. She caught the attention of politicians all the way around the world.
Not always in the most positive way. Along with the giddy excitement, there are also fears that humans would be next to be cloned, sparking visions of doomsday scenarios such as an army of super soldiers. Well, shortly after Dolly's creation, the then US president, Bill Clinton, rapidly announced a ban on human cloning experiments.
It has the potential to threaten the sacred family bonds at the very core of our ideals and our society. But it is our moral obligation to confront these issues as they arise, and to act now to prevent abuse.
So, how big a scientific breakthrough was Dolly the sheep? Pallab Ghosh is the BBC's science correspondent.
It was a huge scientific development, and it causes wave of euphoria, but also incredible panic, as you heard from Bill Clinton there, about whether humans were next. It was something that was on the front pages and the leads of news bulletins, not just for that day, but for days and weeks as people wondered what was going to happen next.
So explain to us exactly what his role was, because he was part of a team.
What the team did in order to create Dolly was that they took an adult cell and took the DNA out of it and put it into an empty sheep's egg. They zapped it with a little bit of electricity, and that turned back the clock of the DNA inside and made it into an embryo that was the exact genetic duplicate of the donor material. And so that was reimplanted, and Dolly was born to term.
She was the first cloned mammal. What has the impact of her creation been now that the initial euphoria and the initial fears have died down?
Well, clearly there have been no cloned human beings, thankfully. There have been all sorts of regulations and prohibitions to try and stop that. Professor Wilmot and the team in Edinburgh who came up with the idea didn't want to clone humans. What they wanted to do was to grow tissue that could be used to treat diseases. So, for example, if someone had a brain disorder, their tissue from any part of their body could be turned into embryonic material, but rather than it grow into clone of the person, it could be coaxed to become the tissue that the brain needed, like nerve cells, and reimplanted. So that was the idea. But the initial hope of using the technology for medical breakthroughs hasn't yet appeared, but progress is being made.
Pallab Ghosh. Still to come.
Remember, the Force will be with you. Always.
For Star Wars fans everywhere, a rare model of an X-wing fighter used in an action scene is up for auction next month.
Unexpected Elements is all about finding the surprising science angles to everyday news.
I love that this show has the scope to discuss both emergent AI, nuclear in Ghana, and also what those stringy bits are on a banana.
And joining the dots between their global connections.
Nature does pack a lot of surprises for us.
An invisibility cloak in the acoustic domain.
So cool. That's Unexpected Elements from the BBC World Service. Find it wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Welcome back to the Global News Podcast. The British Prime Minister, Rishi Sunak, has pledged to defend the UK's democracy in the face of what the government has called a systemic challenge from China, as ministers come under more pressure to officially designate Beijing a threat. Some members of the governing Conservative Party have demanded a full review of Chinese influence in Britain, after it was revealed that a parliamentary researcher had been arrested in March on suspicion of spying for Beijing. The opposition Labour Party has called on the government to explain whether the Foreign Secretary, James Cleverly, was aware of the arrest before his recent trip to Beijing. The researcher says he's innocent and has branded the accusations against him as misreporting. In Parliament, Mr. Sunak told MPs what he'd said to his Chinese counterpart when he met him at the recent G20 summit, and why.
The whole House is rightly appalled about reports of espionage in this building. The sanctity of this place must be protected, and the right of members to speak their minds without fear or sanction must be maintained. We will defend our democracy and our security. So I was emphatic with Premier Lee that actions which seek to undermine British democracy are completely unacceptable and will never be tolerated.
Yeah. China has described the allegations that its intelligence services ran a spy ring inside the British Parliament as malicious slander. Our security correspondent, Gordon Carrera, looks at how espionage has changed in the 21st century.
Spying used to be fairly straightforward. An agent would steal a document stamped top secret and pass it on at a clandestine meeting. That was the world in which the UK's 1911 Official Secrets Act was passed, but much has changed since then. Now there's cyber espionage, stealing online, and the information might be held by companies or universities. There's also greater concern about interference operations, in which spy services try to shape policy and debate. In this new world, China poses a particular challenge. A report from the Parliamentary Intelligence and Security Committee this summer suggested the UK had been slow to wake up to it. The government stresses it is taking action, including a new National Security Act to update the Official Secrets Act. For the first time, it will be illegal to be an undercover foreign intelligence officer. But that power will not come into force until the end of the year, officials say. And a new foreign influence registration scheme will not come into force until next year at the earliest. The Deputy Prime Minister said it was possible China would be placed on the enhanced tier for that register, requiring extra checks. That means it may take some time for there to be a clearer view of what China is up to and how far the authorities will go in confronting it.
Our security correspondent, Gordon Carrera. Rui Pinto is a man that shook the world of football, but not in a way the sport would have wished for. The Portuguese computer hacker is behind the biggest leak of information in the sport's history, publishing millions of confidential documents online. The leaked files included alleged cases of tax evasion and potentially dubious deals involving some top football clubs and star players. Their release has sparked criminal investigations in a number of European countries. Now, after a 3-year trial, Rui Pinto has been given a 4-year suspended prison sentence for attempted extortion and illegal access to data. Pinto's lawyer, Francisco Teixeira da Mota, spoke to reporters after the verdict.
Rui Pinto did not expect to be acquitted because he himself had recognized illegality and he had shown his regret. What he expected was that the public service he provided would also be taken into account, and I believe that this decision recognizes the existence of this public service.
Our reporter Nigel Adderley told us more about the man behind the leaks.
Rui Pinto is a remarkable character in many ways. Only 34 years of age, he calls himself a self-taught computer expert. And he managed to hack into various sources and he revealed a treasure trove in many ways of over 18 million documents. And they were given to a number of very prominent publications across Europe. And as a result of these leaks, a number of football clubs and world-famous football stars were hugely inconvenienced, to say the very least. Among the people, a number of clients from the world-famous football agent George Mendes were investigated for tax evasion, and Cristiano Ronaldo was forced to pay a fine of $20 million to the Spanish tax authorities in the end. There were allegations that football clubs such as Manchester City had infringed UEFA's financial fair play rules. A lot of the information leaked by Pinto was used in an investigation from UEFA, which ultimately banned Manchester City from the Champions League for 2 years until that was overturned on appeal.
But his defence is that he was acting as a whistleblower.
Yes, and it will certainly, I think, make many future whistleblowers in all walks of life think very hard before they choose to reveal their information, because he has always said that he did this in the interests of football. And when he was asked before his sentencing whether he believed it was all worth it, he basically shrugged his shoulders and said, we'll have to wait and see. But he's not just focused on football. He was also behind the famous Luanda leaks. That was around 700,000 emails and other documents, which really explained how the daughter of the late Angolan dictator, José dos Santos, built up her business empire and became the wealthiest woman in Africa. So he's clearly somebody who was very good at being a whistleblower. But the way he carried out his hacking was viewed by many people as extortion.
Nigel Adderley. A UN report says cocaine production in Colombia, the world's biggest producer of the drug, has reached a new record. It rose by nearly a quarter last year to more than 1,700 tonnes. Here's our America's regional editor, Leonardo Rocha.
In its annual report, the UN Office on Drugs and Crime says cocaine output in Colombia is higher than any time since monitoring began more than 20 years ago. Half of the coca leaf crop, which is the raw material for the drug, is grown inside indigenous reserves or national parks. Colombia's left-wing president, Gustavo Petro, has been critical of the war on drugs policies sponsored by the United States in previous decades. He said they led to an increasing violence and victimized vulnerable people in rural areas. But a year after taking office, he's yet to come up with an effective plan to address the problem.
Leonardo Rocha. On Monday, Chileans marked the 50th anniversary of the military coup led by General Augusto Pinochet against the democratically elected government of President Salvador Allende. On September the 11th, 1973, fighter jets roared over the capital, Santiago, firing their rockets at the presidential palace. Tanks patrolled the surrounding streets while soldiers rounded up hundreds of civilian prisoners. Inside the palace, President Allende made his final appeal to the Chilean people.
La historia es nuestra, y la hacen los pueblos.
History is ours. It is made by the people. Workers of my homeland, I have faith in Chile and her destiny. Other men will overcome this grey and bitter moment in which treason seeks to impose itself. Continue in the knowledge that, much sooner than later, the great avenues that lead to the construction of a better society will once again be open.
That was at 9 in the morning. 5 hours later, he was dead, having taken his own life. General Pinochet had seized power and would hold on to it for the next 17 years. James Menendez spoke to someone who remembers that fateful day all too clearly. Sergio Bitter was Allende's mining minister. After imprisonment by the junta and exile in the US, he went on to serve again, most recently as Minister for Public Works under President Michel Bachelet. What does he remember of that day 50 years ago?
Well, the strongest thing I remember is first the bombardment of the government palace on the one side. The second is that I was having lunch with President Allende the day before, so less than 24 hours before he died. So we had agreed on some things. We were four or five ministers that we were discussing with him for his speech next day, the day of the coup. So I was in the hot place all those hours. And then the day following the coup, I was called by a military announcement asking me to present myself to them.
When you were with Salvador Allende the day before the coup, was he, and indeed you, were you expecting it to happen? Did you have any idea that that was what was going to happen?
That was a discussion and rumors that were taking place for months. So that discussion was the last analysis we were doing with the Minister of Defense on his conversations with every general and admiral at the time to explore if that was imminent or we could avoid this thing and solve it through a political decision.
And he felt he had no choice but to take his own life, did he?
Well, I would say those things, when they become so polarized and you are not able to solve it before, to reduce tensions, your range for maneuvering is very narrow. The situation was extremely violent, and the decision from the very beginning with the Nixon administration and his group was to avoid Allende taking the presidency and later to overthrow him.
The Nixon administration thought that Chile was going to become or was becoming another Cuba, didn't they? I mean, what was Salvador Allende trying to do? Was he a communist?
He was not a communist. If you have to define him in his character, he's a democratic socialist. He was a Democrat all his time. He was deputy member of the House, three-time senator, president of the Senate, minister in the 40s of health. So all his trajectory is the trajectory of a Democrat. So the main element that has to be discussed historically and had so much impact in Europe is if it was possible to look for a road for big transformations in a democracy in a poor country. So the discussion was not if he was or not a Democrat, but if the democratic institutions in a poor country with very strong opposition from different forces, as I described, made them that viable or not. That was the discussion.
Sergio Bitter, a minister in the ousted government of Salvador Allende. Now, the Star Wars films, particularly the first three, have spawned a whole memorabilia industry. Devoted fans collect anything associated with the movies made by Lucasfilm. So there's great excitement about a rare model of an X-Wing fighter that's being put up for auction next month. Bids for the model used in a climatic battle scene start at $400,000. Phoebe Hobson reports.
For decades, nobody knew the location of a long-lost model that played a pivotal role in the original Star Wars film from 1977. The X-Wing fighter was used in the final battle, including the famous trench run of Star Wars: A New Hope.
You're all clear, kid. Now let's blow this thing and go home.
It was built by George Lucas's visual effects company, Industrial Light and Magic, but was discovered in a box that belonged to the late Oscar-nominated model maker, Greg Jean. Friends of Mr. Jean had been sifting through his collection that also included an original Stormtrooper costume from A New Hope and an astronaut suit from Stanley Kubrick's 2001 A Space Odyssey. Its intricate detail makes it just one of four models known as hero models. The 50-centimetre model has articulating wings, working lights and battle marks. It means it could be used for close-up shots at a time when special effects technology was struggling to keep up with the demands of film directors.
Great shot, kid! That was one in a million!
Remember, the Force will be with you, always.
Now, the X-Wing fighter's next mission is an auction next month in Dallas. Bidding starts at $400,000 and prices could soar high as some consider it the pinnacle of Star Wars artifacts to ever reach the market.
Phoebe Hobson reporting. And that's all from us for now, but there will be a new edition of the Global News Podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on X, formerly known as Twitter, at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Caroline Driscoll. Producer was Liam McSheffrey. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Janet Jalil. Until next time, goodbye. Thank you.